Marriott Hotel. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and certainly for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who is our guest ordinarily here on last hour of the week. Hi, William. How are you doing?
And I'm doing well. Thanks again for having me on your program.
Well, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
Teeing off what you usually say by way of illusion being enthroned and reality being scoffed at and consigned to the periphery of our life, I think it's worthwhile to take just a second to talk about what we're being told regarding the economy. There's this report this morning that gives you everything you need to know, really, about the reality. And it's something that had an impact on the markets today, and that is the fact that there were 431,000 jobs, quote-unquote, created over the last month, but 95%, actually more than 95% of them, were temporary jobs created by the government, which can't actually create jobs. There were positions that were summoned into existence by the government in order to carry out the census. And, of course, the census is, in the larger scheme of things, really all about locating people in order for them to be taxed. That hasn't changed since the days of Augustus. It probably hasn't changed since the days of Nimrod. The reason why the government wants to be able to count people or locate them is not in order to do them any favors. The reason why government wants to make people visible is in order to mulct them, to pilfer from them, to fleece them, to shear them, to extort from them their hard-earned wealth in order to lavish it on those who are politically favored. That's what the census is all about. Now, the propaganda that has barraged the public for the last more than a year or so about the census is all built on the idea that government somehow is this benevolent, omnipotent force in our lives, that in order to receive the benefits that government uniquely can confer on us, we have to make ourselves known, visible, and be counted. That's not how it works. What they want to do is find out where you are. That, as a matter of fact, is one of the four protocols of the Internal Revenue Service. Find out where they are, learn what they have, and then find ways of getting it from them. That's something that the IRS excels at, and of course the IRS is joined at the hip with the census. All the so-called jobs, with the exception of 41,000 that were actually generated in the badly overtaxed and over-regular private sector, all the job, so quote-unquote, growth that took place in the last month was generated by government, which means that, in effect, the private sector is dead in terms of job creation, and it will remain in that state. It's capable of being resurrected until such time as the government either collapses on account of its accumulated corruption and clusters of errors and unsustainable metastatic growth, or we consign it to its constitutional cage. And quite frankly, those two developments might happen in tandem. You might have to have the first happen in order for the second to take place.
Well, my understanding was that actually there was something like 330,000 jobs lost, and then this 430,000 or 440,000 dollar increase, well over 400,000 were simply census jobs. So we actually lost a lot of jobs last month, but nobody wants to talk about that.
Yeah, and they want to talk about this as a mild recovery. It's not a recovery in any sense of the expression, but they're going to keep peddling this line for as long as they possibly can in the teeth of what is turning out to be the long-anticipated, much-dreaded Greater Depression.
Well, I think we saw from the stock market today that people really realize that we are in real trouble. Despite everything we're being told by the controlled press and by all the pundits and by Washington, D.C., the economy is in terrible straits. It's getting worse. More people are losing their jobs. More people are losing their homes. More small businesses are closing down. We'll be right back. William, go right ahead.
By way of underscoring and really emphasizing the point that there is this connection between the enumeration of the public and the activities of the tax-gathering class, and the fact that the so-called government stimulus is entirely about promoting the growth of the parasite class, the government-connected parasite class, at the expense of the productive, here is a really good study in contrast that I intend to write about at the earliest opportunity. First of all, just this last week, Hewlett-Packard, which is, of course, a major company that's involved in computer and information technology, office products, and things of that sort, announced that they're probably going to be shedding about 9,000 jobs. That's a news item of some consequence here in western Idaho. We're not that far from Boise, Meridian, Nampa, which is pretty much the population hub of Idaho, a thinly populated state with one major urban metroplex. Hewlett-Packard is one of the major elements of the economy in Boise, and so if a Hewlett-Packard decides that it's going to do away with a few hundred jobs in Boise, that will have a great big ripple effect on the very embattled economy here in Idaho. But it's going to be shuttering a number of facilities and probably shedding at least 9,000 jobs. It's doing so not necessarily because of the ravages of the ongoing unfolding depression, although that, of course, plays a role, but because of modernization. They're learning how to adapt to the economic environment in ways that emphasize productivity, which means that there are going to be short-term losses, assuming, of course, that they retain their market share. These losses will be short-term in terms of the number of employees that they have on the payroll. That's what happens in the private sector when you're dealing with economic adversity and when you're dealing with technological innovation. Positions are done away with, and then other positions will be created, of course, if you're dealing with a company that's resilient and that's reacting to a real legitimate demand in the private sector. Now, I want to contrast that with something that's happened in Massachusetts. Massachusetts, of course, is geographically the cradle of American independence. The whole struggle over American independence was rooted in what? It was rooted in tax protest. The colonies did not like the idea of being plundered for the benefit of politically connected elites who were in the service of a distant regime across the Atlantic. And as a matter of fact, the war for independence was fought not over a tax which was in force at the time, but in response to a claim that was being made by the British Parliament that at a time of their choosing they could reimpose these horrible taxes that in terms of absolute tax burden were minuscule compared to what we put up with today, ironically enough. But in Andover, Massachusetts, there's an IRS call center service center.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William is talking, certainly, about the contrast between Hewlett-Packard, which is going to be laying off about 9,000 people here in the United States, as it restructures to become more efficient and be able to compete more effectively, and contrasting that to what's going on in Massachusetts. And Massachusetts, of course, is a very, very socialistic state, and they have all sorts of socialist programs, and they provide health care or subsidized health care for the people there of that state. And, of course, they have tremendous expenditures. The problem is that they're running tremendous deficits. But you go ahead and pick up the story there, yeah. William.
What's happened is that in Andover, Massachusetts, where there's a regional service center for the Internal Revenue Service, there was a schedule that was put into place several years ago owing to the fact that this is a center for the processing of paper tax returns to shutter that service center by the year 2011 because they no longer have the same volume of paper tax returns being filed. Most people are filing electronically and getting electronic refunds when they undergo this annual ritual of being mulcted by the federal government and receiving back some sickly portion of what the government has stolen from them. Though most of this is transacted by way of computer today. There aren't that many paper tax returns. I'm one of the few tax slaves. I don't prefer to call us taxpayers. We're not taxpayers. We're tax slaves. The IRS refers to us as customers. That's really interesting. If you look at the official propaganda of the IRS, they refer to the victims as customers. You know, we're customers of the IRS, I guess, in the same sense that a rapist victim could be considered a girlfriend. But in any case, the Andover Center of the IRS was going to be shuttering its doors in 2011, and they were going to lose something like 1,500 positions there. Now, what did the Mandarin class of Massachusetts do when confronted with this crisis? Now, if they represented the people, that is to say, if they represented the productive citizenry in the state of Massachusetts, then, of course, it's impossible to frame that proposition in a way that's reconcilable with the reality that we live in. But just for a second, let's play with that idea. Let's imagine that Massachusetts actually had political representatives that represented the people rather than the tax consumers. They wouldn't have had any problem with the idea of the IRS center closing its doors. They'd be agitating for something that would remit the expenses of the IRS center to the taxpayers from which those expenses had been extracted. But what they did, every single member of the congressional delegation from the state of Massachusetts, and this is done before Ted Kennedy passed away and Scott Brown replaced him, but I don't think that Scott Brown would have behaved all that differently. Every single one of them started to put pressure on the executive branch to make sure that those IRS employees stayed employed in spite of the fact that their jobs were being defined out of existence owing to the new technology. They had to find make-work jobs for these federal employees. This is from accounting publication. It was published May 14th of 2009. In an attempt to save the economic livelihood of about 1,500 employees at the Internal Revenue Service's Andover, Massachusetts Service Center who are facing the loss of their job this year, a group of six members of Congress has asked the Special Inspector General of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, everybody remember TARP, the Bailout for the Banks program, to ensure preference to Andover employees when hiring to fill TARP jobs and other economic oversight positions. That's one thing they did. Now, another thing they did was they took several million dollars, by several million, I'm talking almost $100 million, in order to renovate the service center that was supposed to be closed in 2011. That's one of the major stimulus funding projects in the state of Massachusetts. $92 million to renovate and expand the campus of the Andover IRS Service Center that was supposed to be closed down. There's a news item from last April 11th that goes into detail about this. With tax day looming, officials from Washington and Massachusetts are blasting a $92 million Cadillac-style renovation of the sprawling IRS Center in Andover, calling the use of federal stimulus dollars to collect more taxes a boondoggle that won't even bring long-term jobs to the area. Now, what has happened, obviously, is that there has been a shift in the political mood here where, owing to the fact that over the last year or so, the tax victim class in this country has grown restive and visible, for the benefit of re-election, this is a year divisible by two, which means that a lot of these people are up for re-election, one-third of the Senate and all the congressional seats are up for grabs this year. They're going to posture and they're going to pose and they're going to mimic the behavior of people who actually believe in limited government and free markets and so forth, just for the benefit of political exposure this year. The project's key proponent, Representative Nikki Tsongas, a Democrat from Lowell, Massachusetts, and other top regional Democrats have strongly touted the project, which is aimed at improving productivity and customer service, there's that word customer again, at the 50-year-old federal complex. But foes such as Senator John McCain of Arizona and Scott Brown of Massachusetts and State Senator Michael Napick of Massachusetts are jeering at the use of stimulus money to create a state-of-the-art processing and auditing center when roads, bridges, and dams need urgent attention. Of course, that's the fallacy of the false alternative. You shouldn't have the federal government underwriting roads, bridges, and dams. Instead, what they should do is let the productive class keep the money, and roads, bridges, and dams will be built and maintained. But this, of course, is all based on the idea that the way to stimulate the economy is to start subsidizing more tax audits by the IRS. And it's no mystery what's going on in our economy right now, when one of the federal government's biggest priorities is to ensure that the Babbitts who occupy the cubicles at the Andover IRS Service Center are all fully employed, even if that means that they're doing nothing but shuffling papers, while taking money from the private sector where jobs are actually created. They're going about, basically, the consummate and thoroughgoing state socialization of the entire economy. And so it's more important that IRS people remain employed than that the money remain in the private sector where productive use can be made out of it. And it's really quite perverse. The expansion of this IRS facility involves, among other things, creating a 7,000-square-foot cafeteria. They're going to put in a brand-new auditorium. They're going to put in a reflecting pool. And this is a building that was supposed to be closed down by 2011 because of the technological obsolescence of what these people are doing. And so what I think is that, say, 40 or 50 years from now, I can't remember the name of the architect. I think his last name was Levy. The architect who's designed these new appointments and expansions of this Andover office, he said that this is a building that will be in use and be relevant 50 years from now, and I'm thinking that it might be relevant in the same sense that a lot of the Soviet-era architecture and monuments remain relevant over in the former Soviet Union and former Soviet Russia, if only to be lasting testaments to the purblind foolishness of central planning. If you want to see a microcosm of everything that's wrong right now and the direction that we're going, I can't think of a better symbol than this building, which has been referred to as the Tax Mahal. It's sort of a shrine to the tax-consuming class. There's a wonderful columnist from Boston by the name of Howie Carr. He writes for the Boston Herald. I don't always agree with him, but I find his writing to be consistently interesting. This is how he describes what's going on in Andover. It will be a temple of taxes, a tax mahal, as the headline puts it, but a fitting symbol for a government run amok, and in a perfect setting, too, the town of Andover, where last year 626 streetlights were turned off because the town couldn't afford them anymore. But now the feds spend $92 million on the same IRS facility, where they just eliminated 1,400 jobs. The Internal Revenue Service, all you need to know about Obamacare is that it will create not one single new physician or health care provider, but it will require hiring new IRS leg breakers. Well, the only stimulus this moonbat administration cares about is big government. Billions are sucked out of what remains of the economy's productive sector to pay ever more outrageous salaries and benefits to politically correct layabouts who spend all day emailing one another and sharpening pencils, assuming that they show up at all, a large assumption indeed. Think of the most posh, ostentatious building in your community. Perhaps it's the five-star resort masquerading as a state courthouse in Pemberton Square or the federal Moakley Courthouse on Northern Avenue. Those are both, of course, in Boston, with its million-dollar harbor views. In the suburbs, it might be one of those new $200 million high schools or the IRS campus in Andover. What all these buildings have in common is that they are public sector. Everyone constructed with a public-be-damned attitude. Meanwhile, on Main Street, every week you drive by more empty storefronts, not to mention shuttered factories or car dealerships, and further out of town, dying or abandoned malls. It's like late medieval Europe, with giant cathedrals towering above the squalid thatched roof hovels that house the peasants, who were stuck with the tab for the church's opulence. Like the bishops of old, the modern mandarins of Omaha's welfare state imperiously command us to do as they say, not as they do. How appropriate that the overseer of this IRS chateau in Andover is Timothy Geithner, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, one of the many serial tax cheats in the Obama administration. Think Charles Rangel, Hilda Solis, Tom Daschle. The private sector can't shape this deep recession as our bureaucratic grandees revel in unparalleled boom times. Take the Department of Transportation. Please, according to USA Today, when the recession began, one DOT employee was making more than $170,000 a year. Just one in the entire department. 18 months later, 1,690 DOT employees were earning more than $170,000. Tell me, what exactly do they do? This is not so stealth redistribution of wealth, not to mention reparations. Of course, we must spend $92 million in stimulus on an IRS playpen in a town where streetlights are now considered an extravagance. Just ask Congressman Nikki Tsongas, another prototypical empty pantsuit Democrat. Represents a district she didn't even live in before she deigned to represent it in the House, and her only qualification is her last name. Now the IRS will probably audit me, but they do it every year anyway. My crime is working for a living not collecting a handout. And of course that's true of so many of us, although earning a living now is becoming a very parlous undertaking indeed.
Well, I really am very, very concerned. Of course, Massachusetts is having terrible, terrible problems as far as because of their socialized medical system. And the insurance companies are pulling out. The doctors are pulling out. People are having long lines to get medical care. Their cost of their medical care is going up. They're running a $200 million budget deficit in 1 year with this wonderful socialized medical system, which was the pattern for the Obamacare. We'll be right back. Go right ahead, William.
One of the things that most people don't...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances? Even things which can cause sickness or disease. If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866- 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
$1 trillion a year we spend on our military and all the various manifestations and the Veterans Administration in care of families and keeping our troops overseas, and they bury all of this, but they can't let the American people realize that certainly a significant part of our budget just goes for the military. And of course, you know, it was the founding fathers who, talking about a central bank, they said, why, a central bank is even more dangerous than a standing military.
Yeah.
Most people do not understand that our founding fathers did not want a standing military. They wanted a navy, but they did not want an army, because they knew that if you had an army, somebody would want to use that army for imperial purposes. In fact, that has really been the plan all along. They couldn't tell the American people that, but there's always been a small group of people going all the way back to Benjamin Franklin who wanted an empire. And if you ever remember that speech he gave there to calling for prayer, he talked about, you know,
yeah,
can a great empire be formed, you know, and of course he was talking about creating an empire, and they wanted an empire, and that's what we have today. But it's costing us almost $1 trillion a year, which we do not have, and one of the major driving forces that is about to bankrupt this nation. And there's no better way to destroy a nation. You don't send it to war and have it lose in war. You bankrupt the nation through expenditures. And that's just what the people who hate America are doing. And Obama is carrying on the same tradition as the previous presidents. Go right ahead.
That's exactly right. If you recall, Madison said that war is the parent of armies, and armies beget debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for making the many subject to the will of the few. In other words, the best way to reduce a nominally free society into oligarchical despotism is through perpetual warfare, either the waging of war or the preparing for war. A lot of people like to quote "Si vis pacem, para bellum." If you want peace, you need to prepare for war. That's an expression, I believe, Tacitus, the ancient Roman historian, is the one who's most prominently associated with that aphorism, and it's one that George Washington talked about. But that was not the case of in Washington's experience. Preparing for war in the sense of looking for some kind of a permanent or open-ended entanglement. The idea is that you are prepared in terms of maintaining a healthy martial culture. In our case, that meant basically a citizen militia, a yeoman farmer population that was acquainted with and able to use firearms effectively. And the idea being that we would maintain a navy for protection and defense of the continental United States at the time, which the United States clung to the eastern seaboard, but the vision was that the navy would protect us as a maritime power. And when you needed to, you could create an army, but it was not supposed to be a constant, permanent feature of the political landscape. But what happens, of course, is that there is this evil entente that exists between those who are promoters of foreign adventurism and those who are promoters of political banking, central banking that's attached to a powerful state dominated by a very powerful executive. That, unfortunately, was Alexander Hamilton's dream. Mr. Hamilton was a man of many parts, some of them quite commendable. He fought with distinction as an artilleryman in the War for Independence. He was largely a self-made man, came from a very disreputable background, and he was somebody who, as he once put it, quoting, I believe, Falstaff from Shakespeare, "If it be a sin to covet honor, I'm the guiltiest man alive." He was somebody who wanted to make a consequential figure out of himself, and he, ironically enough, ghostwrote large passages of Washington's justly famous farewell address, talking about the need to avoid entangling alliances, how we would have to pursue peaceful commerce with all and entangling alliances with none. But unfortunately, the other side, the obverse of Alexander Hamilton, was this dream of establishing a mercantilist system where you would have corporate interests allied with a central bank that would be in cahoots with, in collusion with, a powerful executive, and that they would determine and dominate the economic policy of the United States. That's more or less the dream that we're living under right now, and that's the dark side, as you put it, of the founding era. There were those elements in our founding as well as the ones that we celebrate, and unfortunately, we've reached the point where those elements are dominating today, and we're paying a terrible price for it.
And, of course, the fear is that they're going to bankrupt this nation. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a national debt of $12 trillion, our entire gross domestic product of all the sales and manufacturing and borrowing and selling here in the United States, only $14 trillion, and certainly within a few years, our national debt will be far exceed our gross domestic product, and you cannot survive under those circumstances. Your debt becomes unpayable, and you go bankrupt. Nations do go bankrupt, ladies and gentlemen, and we're well on the way. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William, you go right ahead.
When we're talking about the evil connections, correspondences between the warfare state and central bankers, it's important to recognize, and this is something that far too few people understand, that the reason why we have the Federal Reserve to begin with was the malign ambitions of this semi-submerged, quasi-covert elite to reconstitute the United States as an imperial power. I mean, this is sort of Hamilton's vision on steroids that we're talking about at the turn of the century. We've talked about this before. I mean, but I don't think there's anything wrong with talking about it again. The fact that the Carnegie interests in the early years of the 1900s, the early years of the 20th century, were talking about the idea of bringing about a complete transformation of American society, which was decentralized and rural and smaller republican in the best sense, even as late as the pre-World War I era. And there's no better way, they determined, than getting the United States involved in a war to bring about the social changes they desired in the direction of having a unitary state under the direction of a strong executive and an elite cadre of social planners. And so they needed to find some way to get us involved in a war. Now, in order to fund a war, in order to fund foreign adventurism, you can't have a hard money-based economy. You cannot have a government that's constrained by a gold standard or by some other precious metal standard. The government has to be able to inflate the currency. The government has to be able to devote huge amounts of resources in an unaccountable way to the maintenance of an imperial foreign policy. Take a look at what happened with Rome. By the end of their existence as an empire, they were in the business of being a major power for almost a millennium, but it took them about 300 or 400 years to debase the denarius to the point where it was basically a slug with a thin coating, a thin washing of silver on it. And that's what the dollar is like right now, and the Federal Reserve, which is in charge of counterfeiting, if you will, managed to accomplish that feat in a little less than a century. It's lost 98-99% of its value. And that's why it was created. It was created in order to have an inflatable currency that would be appropriate to the interests of a would-be globe-straddling elite. Now, countries, nations, do go bankrupt.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Grigg. Yeah, this is Dr. Stan. William is simply talking about how if you want to have a warfare state, and why what you need to do is have certainly a system by which the bank, you can actually finance it by borrowing money, by inflating the money, by destroying the value of the currency. And there really are people, of course, who benefit tremendously from that. The bankers, of course, want war. Why? Because, of course, to finance war, you've got to borrow money. You borrow money. Who do you borrow it from? You borrow it from the bankers. You pay them interest, and then they create the money out of nothing. If you have, and this is the secret of banking, bankers create money out of nothing, and then they charge you interest on it. But the average individual doesn't understand the fractional banking system. You're not supposed to understand it. And the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. But eventually, you come to the moment of the time where the whole system implodes. Everybody is impoverished, except, of course, for the wealthy bankers, because they've invested their money in gold and commodities and silver and other things. Their money is safe, and everybody else is impoverished. And then, of course, we start in all over again, except that the vast majority of people loses everything. Well, this is where we're headed, but before we go on with that, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site, how they can listen to your radio program, how they can actually, of course, get to your PayPal button. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. My blog is called Pro Libertate, Latin phrase that means for freedom, and it can be found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Once again, that's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. My radio program is also called Pro Libertate. Pro Libertate Radio airs each Saturday night from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time, which is 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock California Time, or 9 o'clock to midnight Central Time, on the Liberty News Radio Network. The website for Liberty News Radio is libertynewsradio.com. If you go to libertynewsradio.com, there's a list of local affiliates. There are a number of them scattered across the countryside. It's a growing enterprise. I'm very excited to be a part of it because I think that this is the best and most high-impact medium for promoting contrarian views about what's going on. In other words, to promote the reality-based view of what's going on in the world, I think talk radio is probably the best suited to that task. Once again, that's libertynewsradio.com. And there are local affiliates in California and throughout the Southwest and up into the Northeast. And those who don't have a local affiliate, first of all, if you have any influence with anybody in the management of a radio station in your area, would appreciate it if you'd let them know about Liberty News Radio. But secondly, perhaps more importantly and certainly more immediately, you can listen to the program online. It streams online in real time. And if you go to Liberty News Radio, there are many, many ways, many programs you can use select from in order to listen to it as a live streamed program on the internet. Most of our listeners still listen to it by way of the internet. And also podcasts are available. Boy, I have iTunes. There's an archive of my program and all the other programs by all the other hosts at the website as well. That's libertynewsradio.com. As you mentioned, Dr. Stan, on the Pro Libertate blog, at the end of every essay, I do have access to a PayPal account by way of a button that can be clicked by people who have accounts or credit cards or debit cards and are interested in making contributions. That's the chief and sole consistent source of income for myself and my family right now is the Pro Libertate PayPal account. Many people in your audience and many other readers have been extremely generous just in the last month or so. Particularly, there has been a very much appreciated uptick in the number and quantity and amounts of donations that we received. It's been very timely. It's been literally providential for me and my family. And so those who are in a position to do so and are interested in supporting what I do can make a donation by way of the PayPal account by clicking the button at the bottom of every essay at Pro Libertate. I should point out that I had gone an unusually long period of time between postings at Pro Libertate. It's a little more than a week. I just updated it today with an essay talking about this nastiness involving the flotilla headed for Gaza and some of the things that happened that are really part and parcel of this long-running bloody charade in the Middle East. It's the sort of thing that is designed, of course, to pit people against each other as partisans of two distant foreign factions, but the thing that I think is most worthy of remark right now is the fact that the people who are running the conflict on the ground between the Israelis and the Palestinians are in no way, shape, or form interested in seeking a solution that would result in a modus vivendi. They're not interested in peace because the people who write their paychecks aren't interested in peace. They want to keep the conflict going for as long as possible for precisely the reasons that we're describing, Dr. Stan. there's no profit to be had in any kind of an equitable, livable peace. There's a cliche. It became the name of an album about 20 years ago, and that cliche is peace sells, but who's buying? The thing is, most people of any persuasion living anywhere don't really want to see themselves or their families, their children, their loved ones ripped to shreds in an avoidable conflict. That's true irrespective of your background, irrespective of your origins. Granted, there are terrible people who are hostage to horrible ideas. There are certainly elements of that type, excuse me, within the Islamic religion, for instance, and other religions as well, who for whatever reason thrive on conflict, but they're not as numerous as one might think, and they're cultivated very assiduously by the people who have a vested interest in prolonging and profiting from conflict. And what just happened in the Mediterranean this last week is a really good example of the sort of instance that is very carefully arranged and stage managed to bring about maximum effect in terms of keeping people at daggers drawn with each other in this ongoing and vicious charade. And it's of some moment, I think, that the American citizen, U.S.-born Turkish dual national, 19-year-old kid who was killed in the commander raid on the flotilla, was killed by bullets that were purchased with American tax dollars. In the same sense, there are elements of the Muslim Brotherhood who have been involved in helping to create this flotilla. The Muslim Brotherhood has been funded by the CIA for over 60 years. And you take a look at the Hamas group that has been put in power of Gaza, the source and bone of this whole contentious matter. This is a group that was cultivated by Israeli intelligence with the help of the CIA back in the 1980s. And I honestly believe that Hamas was created in order to produce what we might call sort of a hunting preserve of Islamic radicals as part of this cynical game of propping up Yasser Arafat in the late 1980s and 1990s. Every time Yasser Arafat got in political trouble, there'd be an Israeli strike on a Hamas leader. You'd end up with the Hamas leader being targeted and killed by the IDF or by Israeli intelligence. And lo and behold, Yasser Arafat would be the political beneficiary. People would rally around him. The same thing would happen when, for instance, Ariel Sharon, several years ago, would get into political trouble. Suddenly there'd be a terrorist attack, and you'd have these horrible pictures of Jewish merchants or shoppers or people attending discotheques being blown up and killed and injured and maimed. And people would rally around Sharon. And the same thing applies with any Israeli leader and any Palestinian leader. It's as intricately choreographed as professional wrestling, but the big difference, of course, is that innocent people die. And a couple of minutes ago, actually probably about 45 minutes ago, a commenter on my blog made a very perceptive point. He said that here you have Yasser Arafat, who's pretty much the guy who invented air piracy, hijacking. He's somebody who was involved in the death of Leon Klinghoffer, or the U.S. citizen who was thrown overboard the Achille Lauro back in 1985. This is a guy who has the blood of, or had before he passed on a number of years ago, had the blood of hundreds or thousands of innocent people, probably thousands of innocent people, not only Israelis, but also fellow Arabs, fellow Palestinians on his hands. But he could travel anywhere in the world in the serene confidence that he would never be targeted for assassination by the Mossad or by the CIA, because he was necessary. He was vital. He was a tool. He was a foil. He was somebody who was part of this intricate choreography that has been described by a number of people. I think the best book on this is by an American writer named Richard Ben Kramer, who spends half of each year in Israel. It's called How Israel Lost. That book came out about 5 or 6 years ago. And he talks about the fact that at the highest levels, the Israeli government and the Palestinians are in bed together in business deals and in all kinds of other covert, mutually beneficial ententes. And while these people are profiting, the people on both sides of this conflict are dying and suffering. And in microcosm, that's what's going on in the entire world, and it's a reflection of this same bloody-handed, bloody-minded, plutocratic elite that we were talking about just a minute ago, Dr. Stan, and traced back to the visions of Alexander Hamilton, and you can trace it forward through the early 1900s with the creation of the Federal Reserve System is sort of the dynamo driving the warfare state, the warfare welfare, homeland security state. Now we have a $1 trillion war economy, much of it off the record because it's not counted on the budgets. When you have special war appropriations, this isn't counted on the Pentagon budget. Special appropriations are usually voted on several times a year, and we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars that go into maintaining the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Many people might recall that during the campaign, Barack Obama was promising that by the end of the first 16 months of his administration, the United States would be out of Iraq. Well, there are 60,000 U.S. troops still in Iraq. They're not coming out anytime soon. There are probably twice that many mercenaries from various proprietary organizations in Iraq that are carrying out the same kinds of functions. We're more deeply entrenched in Afghanistan than ever before. This has become the longest military engagement in U.S. history. And still, of course, we're hemorrhaging money, and it's not going to stop anytime soon because the people running the affairs of this country don't intend to stop the hemorrhage. This is something that's done by deliberate policy. There is one measure that's been proposed in the House of Representatives by a congressman for whom I don't have any particular respect, Alan Grayson, a Democrat in Florida, called the War is Making You Poor Act. It's supported by Representative Ron Paul, who's usually pretty sound, almost unfailingly sound, on matters of fiscal policy and constitutional principle. And what it would do, War is Making You Poor Act, it would require that the Pentagon not be permitted, or require the Congress, rather, not to engage in this routine business of special Pentagon appropriations, but rather vote up and down on a binding budget for the Pentagon, which means that you would have this institutional pressure being put through the by gearing down the amount of money which is being spent on the military, this institutional pressure being put basically to get the United States out of all these entanglements because they wouldn't be able to keep funding them through these intermittent special appropriations. And I think that's a wonderful, wonderful suggestion. It, of course, is in the realm of things that shouldn't be necessary, because if Congress were carrying out its constitutional function, we wouldn't be doing this. We wouldn't see them do this anyway. And what they're doing, of course, is a routine violation of the Constitution by voting this money, which is off the budget, and not accounting for it. This is a form of criminal accounting fraud, obviously, entirely unconstitutional and improper. But in terms of getting people on the record as to what they're doing, this might be a useful exercise. And I should, while I'm talking about Representative Grayson, and he's as inclined to say petty, foolish, partisan things as just about anybody else on Capitol Hill, he did have the presence of mind to be willing to ask Commissar Bernanke of the Federal Reserve about the money that's being funneled through the Federal Reserve into foreign central banks. And he was willing to be very candid and forceful in pressing Bernanke about the doings of the Federal Reserve. That's something that's very unusual in American politics. He unfortunately didn't support Representative Paul's unexpurgated audit the Fed bill, but at least he's somebody who is promoting, to that extent, a useful public discussion of and exposure of the doings of the Federal Reserve. So I give him qualified plaudits for that, as well as his willingness to promote a measure that's intended to impose some kind of fiscal candid disclosure, full disclosure by the Congress regarding what we're spending on the military. But once again, think about this for a second. How much longer can the United States, I'm not talking about Washington, D.C., I'm not talking about the federal government, I'm not talking about the administrative and tax-consuming class. I'm talking about a country which is in a deep and increasingly deeper, ever deeper economic contraction. How long can we keep supporting an imperial foreign policy? How long are we going to be able to to inveigle foreign interests into supporting, to buying our debt, or how long is the government going to be able to maintain the fiscal charade necessary to support this foreign policy once people stop buying our debt? We have a movement right now on the part of some interests in the Middle East to get out of the euro because of what's going on with Greece and now, of course, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Hungary, all these European countries are becoming crisis-ridden over their public indebtedness. And so there's this artificial and I think temporary flight to the relative security, relative safety of the U.S. dollar. I think that this phenomenon is not going to last much beyond this fall, however, because people are going to realize that there's no the dollar is not a safe haven at all. The euro, of course, has been stronger than the dollar historically, and that's been an indictment of the dollar. But now that the pretense on which the European Union, the fiat currency of that socialist monstrosity, is beginning to unravel, people are starting to pull out of the euro and look to the dollar and T-bills as a relative source of haven and stability. And at the same time, of course, gold is still going up. It's not going up as meteorically as it has, and there's evidence that there's manipulation on the part of the interest behind the scenes to keep gold somewhat artificially suppressed in terms of its price. But what's going to happen, of course, is that as we start dealing with the unyielding reality here, that no jobs are being created, which means that no wealth is being earned in this country to redistribute, the dollar, which is backed right now by force and fraud, what they call the full faith and credit of the United States government, the dollar is going to disintegrate. I don't know how long it's going to take, but we're dealing right now with pretty much the last bounce of the dead cat in terms of the dollar's vitality. So it's an interesting question to contemplate. What's going to happen when the dollar dies? You know, are we going to be in a position where these people who are entrenched overseas in these ongoing foreign entanglements, are they going to be able to come home? Are we going to find ourselves in a situation where we're going to have armies abandoned on the field because Washington can't afford to evacuate them? That's a possibility. That's one of the things that haunt my sleep at night.
Well, and not only that, but what's going to happen to the people who worked their whole life to put amass a certain amount of money to retire on when that money becomes worthless?
Exactly.
People do not understand there's no better way to destroy a nation than to debauch its currency, and there are people in Washington, D.C. who hate America and would like to see it destroyed. We'll be back in just a moment. You go right ahead, William. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
As always, Dr. Stan, I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity. This is a high point of...
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Well, I was horrified when I saw the plight of the people in Haiti after the earthquake, but a similar event could happen right here in the United States, and that's why you should call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD, that's 866-404-FOOD, and purchase a supply of his products. Freeze-drying is a great way to preserve food. I know because I bought a supply 40 years ago, and when I opened a can recently, the food was as fresh and tasty as when I purchased it. We're living in uncertain times, so if you'd like to have a supply of ground beef, diced beef, chicken, vegetables, or fruit on hand, call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD, that's 866-404-FOOD, and mention you heard about him right here at Radio Liberty.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.